you're in trouble because I have the longer cord. So now I can really wander around, see? Yesterday I was kind of tethered to the table. And yesterday when we left off, to some of you who were here, or you weren't here, but if you're listening on tape, we talked about the first four steps, and we're going to talk about step five quickly this morning. We're really behind. This is supposed to be 10, 11, and 12, so we're going to have to catch up. And I'm going to have to go kind of off the book here for a while, and we're going to have to kind of truncate this just a little bit till we get to 10, 11, and 12. But we talked about the first four steps, and what we talked about basically yesterday is that food is not the problem for a compulsive overeater. Food is never the problem for a compulsive overeater. Food is the answer to the problem. And the problem is the untenable, undeniable, searing pain. The pain that comes about in the soul, in the gut, in the head of the compulsive overeater when we're not eating. And that pain is so untenable, it's so unbearable, that the pain of eating becomes preferable, and we hope against hope that maybe this time we'll be able to control it, but we cannot bear the pain any longer, so we eat. And we talked yesterday about any time the buildup of emotions gets to be too high. And it could be emotions of happiness. It could be emotions of elation. It could be emotions of euphoria. It could be anger. It could be fear. It could be depression, not clinical, but, you know, sadness. It could be jealousy, guilt, shame, remorse, whatever it is that is building up and building up and building up. Eventually, it's going to knock on the door of the brain, and the brain is going to say, eat the food. And the intelligent part of me is going to say, no way. And the emotional part of me is going to say, eat the food. And the intelligent part of me is going to say, no way. Now, yesterday we talked about this, and what we said yesterday is, anytime the emotional meets the intelligent, the emotional wins 100% of the time. 100% of the time. That the intelligent cannot overtrump the emotional. And so what we're doing in the steps is we are having a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps so as to lower the emotional level to the point where it doesn't build up and demand the food. Because if I'm having a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps, my emotions will not build up to that level, and I will not see the need to eat the food. I have 16 years of abstinence, and I've lost a little over 500 pounds, and I get asked this all the time. How do you do it? And I say, I work the steps. What they really want to know when they say, how do you do it, is what's your food plan? And I don't tell them. See, I thwart them. I won't tell them. See, it's a secret. No, it's not a secret. But I work the steps, and if I have a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, I will not find it necessary to eat the food. The fact of the matter is I have over 16 years of freedom, and the reason that I haven't eaten Kit Kat bars or Raisinets or Doritos is I don't want them. I don't want them. So we talked yesterday about the fourth step at the end. Uncover, discover, and discard. We're going to uncover, discover, and discard. Now we're going to talk about step five, and we're going to kind of run through five, six, seven, eight, nine as best we can while covering the stuff. The fifth step is very simple today compared to what it was in 1939 when the book came out. I have to find someone who is informed on the big book so they can point out my part in things, but yet uninvolved. What does that mean? Let's just say, for example, that Gregor is a friend of mine, and I've been friends with Gregor for, say, 20 years, just for the sake of this scenario. And Donna comes to me and says, will you do my fifth step with me? And I happen to know for a fact that Donna is Gregor's employer. She owns the company that he works for. Do I listen to her fifth step? No, I do not. Because I'm not going to be I'm going to be involved in that. I'm going to be invested in my friendship with Gregor, so I tell Donna that I cannot listen to her fifth step because she employs my friend. And I can tell you for sure that he is going to probably be on her fourth step. So I decline, I recuse myself at that moment from listening to Donna's fifth step. You have to find someone who is informed, but yet not involved. So that's very, very important. And we have a wonderful, wonderful experience when we do the fifth step, but I cannot tell you the number of times I have listened to fifth steps from people, and I have never seen them again. And I think that the number one reason for that is because people think that their work at that point is done, and it is indeed not done. It is indeed not done. That's why that's step 5, and that's why it's not step 12. Let's go to the bottom of page 76, or 75, excuse me, the bottom of 75. Returning home, these are specific instructions. Returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything, for we are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement? Men put into the foundation, have we tried to make mortar without sand? And what that's asking you there is, to the best of your knowledge, have you done a good job? Now, we also said yesterday that we're not looking for perfection, and a hammer to the head is not one of the tools of recovery. If you've done the best you could, let it go. Every good artist knows when it's time to put the brush down. You've done the best you can. You've remembered everything you can possibly remember. Sorry, people on tape. You've done everything to remember what you have. And you've done your best. Now it's time to move on. Now we're going to do steps 6 and 7. And if there are 2 steps that are very overlooked, they're 6 and 2. 6 and 2 are the most overlooked steps. Well, 2 and 10 are the most underutilized. But 6 is a distinct step. We are ready to have these defects of character removed. Now, if you remember yesterday, we talked about the fact that there are 4 basic impediments that human beings have to a spiritual awakening. 4 of them. The first one is a resentment that you will not let go of. The second one is a vicarious thrill that you will not let go of. The third one is an amends that you will not make. And the last one is a secret that you will not tell. So in keeping with the secret that you will not tell, we just did step 5. I hear things from people in their 4 steps. They have never told their parents, their best friends, their spouses, whatever. We hear this all the time. We keep it in confidence because it is imperative we do these things to have a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps. Now we're going to be talking mostly about the vicarious thrill that you will not let go of. I love getting away with a lie. Oh, I love getting away with a lie. Oh, it is so awesome. I love stealing and getting away with a lie and backstabbing and gossiping. Oh my God, there's a whole cottage industry based on gossiping and backstabbing and all this stuff. People love it. People love doing it. They love reading about people who do it. It's wonderful, isn't it? If I want to eat M&Ms, I'll go right back to it. So let's go to the top of 76. If we can answer to our satisfaction, we then look at step 6. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can He now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. These are specific instructions. You're not willing to live this way? Ask God for willingness. Now, the 7th step is the place in the book where I'm going to have to take my program of recovery out of the laboratory, out of the safety of the rooms, and bring it into the world that I live in. I own a business. Can I operate my business honestly? Can I operate my life honestly? Can I go out into the world and not lie? Can I go out into the world and be honest? Can I go out into the world without selfishness, self-seeking, dishonesty, anger, and fear? Because I'm a human being, I'm going to have to work step 10 constantly, and we're going to get to that in just a little bit. Because on my own accord, I cannot keep these defects of character from coming back. Because no matter how evolved my recovery gets, I will never rise above the level of a human being. And as a human being, these things are going to come back to me. If I spit on you, I'm sorry. It's part of the danger of sitting up front. So the bottom line is, I am willing to have God remove these defects of character, but I have step 10 and step 11 to help me constantly be rid of these things. Okay, because they are going to come up. Okay, let's look at step 7 very quickly here. Step 7 on page 76. When ready. Now, I don't want to say this alone. If you really are ready to be rid of your defects, it's early in the morning. I'm tired. I was on my feet all day. I can't talk. Okay, Mike, we say something like this. My Creator, thank you. I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. We have completed step 7. Now we're going to talk about step 8. And if you go to most meetings, yes, I'm going quickly. I have to make up time. She's already yelled at me because it's supposed to be 10, 11, and 12. And I'm already... Anyway... Think it's easy up here? It's not. Here, you. Okay. So we have a situation here where 8 is also a very overlooked step. And when I go to a step meeting and the subject is step 8, invariably we kind of jump over 8 and go right to 9. Don't you? Yeah, I'm seeing a lot of people that agree with that. Let's talk about step 8 because there is a willingness to make amends to people. And I have to be willing to make amends to certain people that are dead. My mother died in 1976, in July of 76, when I was 22. My father died when I was 24. He died in November of 78. And I didn't come to my first meeting of Overeaters Anonymous until February 2nd, 1979. And I had to look back on my relationship with certain people that I could not find, and my primary amends were to my mother and my father. My mother was mentally ill, as I told you yesterday. My mother had 3 very distinct personalities. My mother was unpredictable and unwieldy. My mother could be a 3-year-old, and in 1 second she could be a 3-year-old and have a conversation with you as if she was 3. My mother could suck in air and become a screaming, raving lunatic. A screaming, raving, enraged lunatic. And my mother could also be suck in air. And she is the most together, informed, well-read person you will meet. And you begin to think at some point, maybe it's you. And I could not control these personalities, and I could not control the comings and the goings of these personalities, although I desperately wanted to control it. And I hated her for that, and I was ashamed of my mother for that, and I really hated being her son. I hated my name. I hated my life. I hated being fat. I hated a lot of things about my life. And like most compulsive overeaters, we said yesterday, one of the things we love to do is assign blame. And so my mother became the lightning rod for everything that was wrong in my life. And I wanted Rob and Laura Petrie for parents, and I got Max and Virginia Grabowski, which is very, very different. My father was a wonderful guy, and my mother was a wonderful lady. If they had $10, they'd give you 20. If they had 20, they'd give you 50. But my mother was mentally ill, and I remember one incident when I was a kid, 10 years old. And it was 1964, I was 10 years old, and McDonald's announced that they were going to open all year long. And they also announced that, see, there was a time when they used to close in the winter. Some of you don't remember that, but they sure did. And they announced that they were going to stay open all year long. And to kick it off, one of the special things that they were going to do is if you had a bicycle, you could bring it and they would give you a license plate with your name on it. So me and my friend David Iglow and David Ives and Robert Parr and Alan Ettinger and, you know, we went down to McDonald's over on Peterson and Kimball in Chicago. And they got their license plates for their bike. And my mother was in the hospital with pneumonia at this time. This is the summer of 64. Now, pneumonia in 64 was a little different situation than it is today. Today, if you have pneumonia, they give you some antibiotics and you pretty much go home. But in 1964, my mother was in an oxygen tent and she was this and, you know, it was pretty bad. She was in Bethesda Hospital. And they didn't have a license plate with Harlan on it.
Oh, my God.
I thought someone getting cancer and me not getting a license plate, they're the same. And, you know, the last thing a fat kid wants to be is different. The last thing the fat kid wants to say to himself is, I can't have what the other kids have. And I wanted a license plate with my name on it. And I'm crying. And the guy goes, I've got Howard. I've got Harold. That's not my name. And I was so upset. You know, I can laugh about it now. And it was a Friday. And I drove my bike home crying. And I threw my bicycle down at, you know, and I ran up to our apartment. And there was my mother on the phone telling me some things that they wanted. She wanted me and my dad to bring her when we came to see her that night, and I opened up on her and I told her, I hope you die. I hope you die in that hospital. How could you give me this effing name? I hate you and I hate you and I hate you and I hate you and F you. My mother didn't miss a beat. She says to me, why are you going to McDonald's? I left you hamburgers in the freezer, but she didn't miss a beat. Didn't miss a beat. And I remember that. And that now she's tracked down my dad. This is in the days well before cell phones, but she knew how to track him down. And he comes up the stairs. And if there's one thing my dad did not want, if you were going to rattle his cage, he was going to rattle yours. If you didn't make trouble for him, he wasn't going to make trouble for you. And up he comes. What in the hell happened with your mother? What did you do? He was fit to be tied, and oh, we had it out that night, and he was absolutely livid with me for making trouble for him. How do you make amends for a mother that you treated so horribly? If I could have done anything to hurt her, I would have done it. Her tears, her crying was the music of my life. My greatest joy in life was her misery. And my greatest misery in life was her happiness. And I often did things to self-sabotage my life and not do as well as I could have because I knew that the payoff would be that it would hurt her. And if I could hurt her in any way possible, I would do it because there was such a charge that would go through me when I did. How do you make amends for a mother that you treated so shabbily? What do you do? What do you do to make amends to a father who you were ashamed of, who you thought was less than the other dads? My father came to this country under the most murderous, the most horrific conditions imaginable. He came out of a nightmare to this country, and he kissed the ground of this country every day, and he thought that the greatest thing in his life, how he survived the hell that he survived, was so that I could be an American. He never, ever said, why did you kill my mother, my father, my sisters, my brothers, my nieces, my nephews, my cousins, my grandparents on both sides that were obliterated off the face of the earth for nothing? But he said to God, why did you let me live? I don't want to live in this world, he would say, because I know they're going to come back and kill us one day. And this was an everyday thing with him. He'd say to me, when they came to kill me, I got away. He'd say, one day they'll come to kill you, and one day they'll come and kill your children. That's what I heard from him every day. So I took it out on him because of that reality. And I did things to him to let him know I was ashamed of him. I was embarrassed by him and I didn't like him. And how do you make amends for this? Now I was in program, I told you, in 1979 I came into these rooms on February the 2nd at the Orchard Mental Health Center in Skokie, Illinois. Marilyn was at my first meeting. Marilyn brought OA to Chicago, and she became one of my first mentors in this program. And there are people that I run into from time to time. From the earliest days of my OA, there's a lady that lives in Palm Springs, California, that was at my first meeting, and I still have contact with her today. And it brings me home. It settles me and lets me know this is my home. But getting back to the ACE step, how do I make amends for that? I came in 1979. And between 1979 and 1994, I looked at this resentment that I had and these harms that I had done my parents. And I looked at it from the standpoint, from the perspective of that I didn't choose them. And that I came to an acceptance that God had chosen these parents for me, and that's about as far as I got. But something happened on December 14th, 1994, that changed my perspective. And at 4:27 p.m. in Eugene, Oregon, at Sacred Heart Hospital, my daughter was born. And she was born under horrific conditions. She was jaundiced and she was premature and she was this and she was that. And my kid was orange at the time. I'm looking around, does anybody have anything on this? No, maybe she was the color of that scarf, a little darker. Well, a little darker than that scarf, okay. And they're putting her in the isolette. And they took her from birth, they dried her off. And they had told us that there was a very good possibility that because my then wife was under so many drugs, because my wife had hyperemesis gravis, which means she vomited constantly. You know that morning sickness? It's a misnomenclature. She vomited around the clock. And my daughter was born, and they said, it does not appear that baby is blind, and that's one of the things they prepared us for. But that's a relief. So they brought her into the neonatal intensive care unit, and they dried her off in the other thing, and they took her in, and they says, can you carry her? I says, yes, absolutely, she's my kid. And they said, are you sure? Yes, and they walked, you know, waiting to catch her if I dropped her. Which, of course, I didn't. So they put her in, and when they give medicine to little newborns, they don't put it in the arm like they would us. They put it in the head and the feet. The head and the feet. And I'm seeing my little daughter, my little Tatala, my little daughter is in this isolette, and she's struggling, and they're sticking needles in her, and she's just uncomfortable as hell, and bam! At once, I understood how much I hurt my mother. For the very first time in my life, I looked at it from her perspective. Instead of me not choosing to have a mentally ill mother, I understood instantly that she did not choose her mental illnesses either. And I stopped looking at what I had lost by having a mother that was mentally ill, and I started looking at what she had lost by having a crazy, angry, compulsive overeater son. And I started looking at the world that lost out because she was mentally ill. I stopped looking at what I had lost and stopped looking at the potential in me that had been thwarted and impeded, and I started looking at what she could have done with her life, and my whole perspective changed. And I look at my mother today, and when I'm feeling down about anything, if I think of her, if I'm doing the right thing, like being here with you, I feel her with me. I definitely, when I do my swimming, I feel her with me. When I serve OA, I feel her with me. I got stuck in the Houston airport for 14 hours on my way to do a big book study in Mobile, Alabama last year. and I got stuck in the Houston airport, and I was pretty frustrated. And they have different events at the Houston airport when people get stuck there. They have the 30-foot luggage throw, like throwing your suitcase is going to do something to get you an airplane. And then they have the swearing at the 30-year-olds or the 20-year-old gals behind the desk. And then they have the eat-a-thons and the drunk-a-thons. I didn't have to engage in any of that. I kept my perspective, and one of the ladies said to me, "Are you on the canceled flight from Mobile?" She says, "You've been very nice." She says, "I'll get you to Mobile on the next flight." She says, "All these people on standby, they're not all going to get on the flight. I'll get you a ticket on the flight." I left my house at 5:45 in the morning in Scottsdale, Arizona. I finally got to Mobile, Alabama. It was 2:00 in the morning. And I felt my mother with me. I don't know why. All of a sudden, I just, "Thanks, Ma. Thanks, God. Thanks, Dad." You know, how do you make amends to a mother that you treated so shabbily? You work the steps and you recover. Because everything that she wanted for me is the same as what I would want for my daughter. And that is to live fully and live in the grace of God and to live in recovery and live in the sunshine of the Spirit. That's what she would have wanted for me as a mother. I know she loved me. I don't doubt that. And it's the same thing with my dad. The murder and the mayhem that that man saw firsthand. Good Lord. And we were walking off the cemetery, and my very, very dear friend, who is the sister of another dear friend, they're both friends of mine, she turned to me on the cemetery, and she said, "Mr. G is safe. They'll never get him now. There's nothing they can do to him now." And I thought to myself, you know, you're right. There's nothing they can do to him now. He's invulnerable to hate, and he's invulnerable to murder, and he's invulnerable to that mayhem. And how do I make amends to him? I make amends to him by working the steps and living in the sunlight of the Spirit. So that all those people who were dead and killed in their graves back in the old country can know, I'm here, and they're not getting me, and neither are the M&Ms or the Kit Kat bars. They're not getting me. And there are people whom I hurt and people whom I harmed that I cannot find. I remember when I was also 10. Remember I told you yesterday when I was 10 I was on amphetamines? That'd make anybody crazy. Let me just tell you. That'd make anybody nuts, okay? And we were playing baseball with a rubber ball, thank God. We were playing with a rubber ball, and I was pitching, and I thought, wouldn't it be funny if I, instead of pitching to the batter, I threw it into the few kids that were watching the game, and I hit a kid named Wendell in the stomach, and I was 10 and he was 4. And I wanted to make everybody laugh. And everyone did, except him. He cried. I hurt him. I hit him with that ball. And I can't find him. And I wish I could tell him how sorry I am. And I wish I could tell him how much I wish I had never done that. I wish I could tell him how deathly, deathly sorry I am. But I can't find him. I can't find him because it's just too many of them out there. So what I have to do, what I'm challenged to do, is to live knowing that God will take care of the restitution owed him. God's got my back, and he's got your back. Now let's talk for a minute about step 9. We have to get to 10, 11, and 12 here. Step 9 is so important. Now some of you have different types of amends, but most of my amends were money amends. I didn't kiss anybody's girlfriend. Damn it. I didn't kiss anybody's wife. Damn it. But what I did was I racked up a lot of debt. I racked up a lot of money amends. And I had to pay that money back. And somebody very wise said to me, if you were smart enough to steal that, you're smart enough to pay it back. And I was really scared because I didn't want to pay it back, and I didn't know how I would live having to pay it back. So I arranged payments with all these people, and I had to arrange everything. And I owed the state of Illinois money, and I owed the feds money because I wasn't paying my taxes. And out of nowhere, my employer at the time loaned me thousands of dollars, interest-free, and he got me the services of his attorney. This attorney was an attorney that was also an accountant, CPA, and he was accredited to plead before the IRS, and he went and made settlements for me. If I would have had to have paid him, I couldn't have afforded him. And then he went to work at no cost to me on restoring my credit, and within about 3 months, I was able to buy a brand new car. So I'm going to tell you something that's going to happen in your life if it hasn't happened already. You're going to experience unexpected miracles from unexpected direction at times when you least expect it but most need it. Challenge God. See if you can find Him wanting. You cannot do it. You will not be able to find where He is weak. You will not be able to find where He will abandon you if you just keep working the steps. And little by little by little by little, I looked around, and one day I was even with the house. And one day I also had one amends that got by me. That was not my money, but our money, because I was married at that time. And I went to my then wife and said, I need to make this amends. And she was completely, she said, you go right ahead and do that. I understand completely. Now, step 9 is a very, very important, very, very important thing. You remember yesterday we talked about Sam Shoemaker. And that Sam Shoemaker, he taught Bill Wilson that there were 4 impediments to a spiritual awakening, spiritual experience, 4 of them. One of those impediments that we talked about is a restitution, which Bill made into an amends, a restitution that you will not make. And see, we get this impression that Dr. Bob got sober right away after meeting Bill Wilson. Not so. Not so. You see, they met on Mother's Day, May 13th, 1935. And that was a Sunday, but Dr. Bob didn't get sober until June the 10th, 1935. What happened in the interim? Well, in June, Dr. Bob was scheduled to go to a meeting, go to a convention in Atlantic City, New Jersey, of the American Medical Association. And Ann Smith begged Bill Wilson, please, Bill, don't let him go. He gets drunk at this thing every year. Please don't let him go. And Bill Wilson said something to Ann Smith that's very profound. He said simply, Annie, God has either removed Bob's compulsion to drink or He has not. And sure enough, Dr. Bob went to the convention drunk. He got drunk in the train station on the way to the convention. He remained drunk the entire time he was there. And he came home and he went to the nurse. He went to his nurse's home that was his nurse from his medical practice. And the nurse calls Ann Smith and says, guess who's at my house drunk? It was Dr. Bob. And Dr. Bob came back to the home at 455 Ardmore Street in Akron, Ohio. And by the way, go there. Go there. You'll love it. Stand in that house. See if you can not cry. If those walls could only talk, go to the Akron house. Before God closes your eyes, get there. Get there. And Dr. Bob had surgery scheduled the next morning, June the 10th, 1935. And he said to Bill, I can't do the surgery, I'm shaking. And the morning of June the 10th, 1935, Dr. Bob was shaking. And Bill Wilson did something for Dr. Bob that a lot of sponsees in AA wish their sponsors would do for them. He popped open a beer and let him drink it so that it would steady his hand and he could do the surgery. And the plan was that he would do the surgery and Bill would wait for him in the parking lot, I sat in that parking lot and cried like a baby when I was in the Akron. Oh, my God. And he says, I'll wait for you. Hours and hours and hours go by. No Bob. Bill Wilson finally goes back to the home on Ardmore Street, and he says to Ann Smith, I haven't seen him. And Bill and Ann Smith really believed that the beer had triggered Bob's allergy and that he was off to the races once more. 11:45 the night of June the 10th, 1935. 11:45 p.m. Down Ardmore Street comes Dr. Bob, sober as anything. What had changed? What had happened? He had gone around Akron making restitution to the people that he had harmed through his drinking. And because he was willing to work the tenets of the Oxford Group movement, he never found it necessary to ever drink liquor again. And he died in November of 1950, sober, with 15 years plus of sobriety. And he was able, through his tremendous, tremendous character and his tremendous patience, to leave a permanent mark on the world that we live in because of his willingness to make his restitution. And if it worked for Bob, it will work for you. Before we move on, I just want to tell you about one amends that I had to make, and I want to do this quickly because we are pushing the clock. When I was eating big time, I had what was called a hot tooth. A hot tooth is a tooth that the nerve is dying, and it hurts really bad, and then it doesn't hurt at all. And it hurts really bad, and it doesn't hurt at all. Well, now it was in the hurts really bad stage, and I got through a referral, a guy that did root canal, because when a tooth is dying like that, you got to go to a root canal. So I go to this guy's office. It's about a block from where I went to high school in Chicago. And I go in there, and the nurse or the hygienist, whatever it is, they sit you down in the chair, and they shoot you full of Novocaine, and you're waiting for the guy to come in. Comes into the office. The very first thing this guy says to me is, my God, how much do you weigh? He goes, you're the most obese man I've ever seen in my life. Very nice to meet you, too. And he says to me, I'm really afraid you're going to break my chair. And I just spent $2,500 on the chair to fix the chair. And the weight limit on my chair is 500 pounds. And you're well over 500 pounds, which I was. And now I'm numb in the gum and numb in the thing in the mouth. And now I'm shut down emotionally because now he's screaming at me about how fat I am. And sure enough, son of a, I broke his chair. He's trying to move me around, and we heard the snap of a part of the chair, and sure enough, I broke his frickin' chair. Now he's enraged, and he's yelling at his daughter, and his daughter had scheduled the appointment. She was the, you know, the nurse or whatever. She was in charge of the office. She was good looking, too. But anyway, the bottom line is, I broke his chair. Now, I had dental insurance at that time, and the copay on that visit was $62. You know what this guy can do for his $62, right? Right there, baby. No way. Years go by. Now it's 1986, and I'm doing a fourth step with a big, big man. And he's huge, and his name is Tom. And he's going to kick my butt if I don't go make amends to this doctor. And I'll be dipped in oil before I'm going to make amends to this guy. Boil the oil? I don't care. I ain't doing it. So I'm pushing this back and back and back. And finally, I had nothing else. Go make amends for this guy. Shit. So I go to the bank right across the street from the guy's office. I go to Liberty Federal Savings. And I get a 50, a 10, and two ones. $62. And I go across to make amends to the dentist. And I don't see his name on the door. But I see his daughter in there. She was still hot. So I go in there. I go in there. And I want to give the guy the $62. And she says to me, "Wow, you look different." I says, "Yeah, thanks." And she doesn't want the money. She said, "My dad died about a year ago." Didn't sadden me, but that's all right. I'm recovering, but I'm not perfect. I mean, come on. But no, I was very sad for the guy. So anyway, I finally gave her the $62, and she apologized for that day. She remembered it well. I got to tell you something. When I went home that day, my tires did not touch the ground. And the last thing on my mind was eating excess food. It wasn't even in my mind to eat the food on my food plan. Food was the last thing on my mind. You can't buy that good of a feeling. You can't buy that kind of euphoria. You can't buy that kind of contentment. That's what I want for you. That's what I want for the people that you will go out and sponsor. That's what I want for everybody that walks through the door of Overeaters Anonymous, is to feel that way when you're not loaded with Three Musketeers bars. I want you to feel that good. Because nothing feels better than recovery. Nothing feels better than that feeling in your heart that says, "I'm doing the right thing." Is it a wonder that perfectly placed in this wonderful book, between steps 9 and 10, are the so-called promises on page 83? Let's go to 83, please. Bottom of 83. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize. The key word there is always. If we work for them, the key word there is work for them. Not sit around hoping. There's no chapter sitting around on your rear end and hoping. There is a chapter into action. This is not a program for people who need it. It's not a program for people who want it. It's a program for people who
do it.
Ah, very good. Now we're ready to go home in an hour here or so. Okay, good. Step 10 is another very misunderstood step. Because no matter how evolved my recovery gets, I will never rise above the level of a human being. And as a human being, I'm going to see girls that I want to kiss and I can't kiss them. The state of Arizona frowns on that. I'm going to see houses that I want to live in and they won't let me. The state of Arizona also says don't. And I'm going to see cars that I want to drive and I can't drive them. And I'm going to see things and all kinds of things that I want and I can't have them. And that's part of the human condition, isn't it? And things are going to happen that are going to make me scared, and things are going to happen to make me angry and selfish and self-seeking, and maybe I'll try a little dishonesty, try to force my will in there, you know, because I'm human, I want what I want, right? And step 10, somehow, I don't know where this Narishkite comes into fellowship. What's Narishkite, guys? Foolishness. Very good, very good. I've even got the non-Jews doing that. That's great. Okay, Jews help the Gentiles with some of the Yiddish. Okay. Now, we have situations like that. And when these things come up, and it's not if they come up, it's when they come up, we're going to do 10 steps throughout the day. We're not just going to do a 10 step in the morning or a 10 step at night. That's 11. We're going to get to that in a minute. 10 step calls, 10 step outreaches are done all through the day as these things come up in our lives. Let's look at the specific instructions, and let's look at the reiteration of step 10 and how it brings into focus other steps. Because you remember that all through the tapestry of the big book is repetition. Repetition. God knew, and through Bill illustrated for us beautifully, that the alcoholic mind doesn't just absorb things. Why? Because my confusion is equal to what my ego does not want me to see. Let me say that again because it's important. My confusion is equal to what my ego does not want me to see. See, if they wrote a sentence in the big book that says, jump on one leg and you'll get everything you want right now, everybody would know that sentence by heart. But because none of it is telling you that, we try to distort it. We try to alter it. We try to forget it. My confusion is equal to what my ego does not want me to see. Nothing is good or bad. There are just things that my ego really doesn't want to hear. So let's take a look at step 10 and let's see the tapestry of repetition. And let's see the beauty of the melody of it, the harmony of it, as it comes through. This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. We have entered the world of the spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. I had a woman come up to me in New Jersey, and she said to me, can I call you when I'm done with my steps? And I said, no. And she said, why not? I says, because when you're done with the steps, you'll be dead. It says it should continue for our lifetime. And invariably, when I get a call from somebody somewhere that is in relapse, what is the number one thing that they stop doing? They stop doing the work. They stop doing the steps. And this is one of those steps that they will begin to stop working very soon. The food goes in the mouth usually 120 days after the relapse begins. And this is where the relapse will usually start taking place if you're this far along. You start harboring resentments. You start harboring fear, and you don't reach out. You don't want to bother people. Isn't it funny how people on a 10-step call, am I bothering you? You never worried about bothering the guy at Domino's. You never worried about bothering the cashier at Dunkin' Donuts. Now all of a sudden you're so concerned about me. Don't be so concerned and don't be so polite. Go in there and fight for your recovery and don't worry about it. You weren't worried about the guy delivering your pizza. Get here, get here, get here. Now all of a sudden you're so concerned. Okay. This is continue. Here's your basic instruction, and it's so simple. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. What step did we use to deal with resentment, four, very good. When these crop up, notice it doesn't say if, it says when. We ask God at once to remove them. What two steps do we use to try to get God to remove our defects? 6 and 7. So we've done 4, 6, and 7, haven't we? We discuss them with someone immediately, not when you get home, not when you're done with your show, immediately. What step did we use to discuss something with someone? 5. And make amends quickly if we've harmed anybody. What two steps did we use for that? 8 and 9. So far we're doing 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and we're doing 10. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Resolutely means with purpose. What step in the future are we going to use to help others? 12. So love and tolerance of others is our code. So far, we've used 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 12. I dare you to work 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 and 12 every day, many times a day, for the rest of your life, and eat Kit Kat bars. You cannot do it. You would have to be literally suicidal. You would have to be psychotic delusional to put the food in your mouth at that point. You wouldn't even want it. I challenge you to do this. I challenge you to live this way. I challenge you to live this way. I go to meetings in North Scottsdale with a woman who lies constantly about her age. All the time. She will not tell the truth. She runs around telling people she's 83 years old. I don't believe her. I don't believe her. I go to meetings with her. She's really 27. If you heard the opening speaker Friday night, for those on tape, buy the tape. She has more vitality, more vigor in her finger than the 35-year-olds that walk in the food. She has more attentiveness, more vim, more vitality than the 30-year-olds coming in, because she lives this way. And when she lives this way, she doesn't eat that way, and she's available. When you talk to her, it's an open channel. It's not, This is the living proof of what I'm talking about. Don't necessarily look at me. Don't necessarily look at one or two people. But here right in the back is a living example of someone who lives that way. The only dishonest thing she tells people is she's 83. I happen to know for a fact she's 27, not 83. Thanks. Thank you. Okay. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even food, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as if from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. It is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. I say that prayer about 1,000 times a day. These are the thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It is the proper use of the will. Much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction from Him who has all knowledge and power. If we have carefully followed directions and have begun to sense the flow of His Spirit into us, to some extent we have become God conscious. We have begun to develop this vital sixth sense, but we must go further, and that means more action. Step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. We shouldn't be shy on this matter of prayer. Better men than we are using it constantly. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it, not think about it, not pray for it, work at it. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. Now, why is the nighttime part before the daytime? It's assumed you've been doing step 10 all day. Now before you go to sleep, let's see the tapestry of repetition here again. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? What step did we use for that? Four, thank you, and 10. Do we owe an apology? What step did we use to admit when we were wrong? 10 and 8 and 9. Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? 5. Were we kind and loving toward all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time, or were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the stream of life? But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. On awakening, here's your daily guidance. Taking a daily guidance is ancient stuff. Bill Wilson said many times in his life, we invented nothing. These are all ancient teachings, ancient practices. You take your daily guidance and you bounce off another person. I email my sponsor every morning with what I'm going to do for the day and where I'm going to go for the day, because I want to bounce that off to somebody else. If I'm taking a tour of the Hershey factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, that's probably something he needs to know. Okay. On awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. In thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Here we ask God for inspiration, an intuitive thought, or a decision. We relax and take it easy. Now, so I'm going to get calls invariably about how do you know the difference between your will and God's will? And it's very simple. God is a very, very good communicator, but he communicates very quietly. You know in your heart what the right decision is. When you're fighting it and you're going upstream, because my ego speaks in caps with exclamation points. It wants what it wants. It wants it now. I want it now. I want it now. And God's will is very subtle. Shh, be still. I'm God. I'm here. I'll take care of it. I understand. I know. Shh, Tatala. Quiet down. I'll take care of it. God speaks very slowly, but we've been giving God the finger for a long time. We've been giving God the one finger salute for a long time. And once we get going on our will, now we're going to ask God to come in and fix the mess we made. And if we had only listened to him in the first place, we'd have been better off. Take that good orderly direction, G-O-D, God. Take it because it's in your heart, it's in your soul, it's in your gut. Know that he is there and he's talking to you, but it's quiet. And in order for you to hear it, you're going to have to be quiet. You've got to stop shouting. I had to learn to stop telling God how big my problems are and start telling my problems how big my God is. Because we all have that voice inside of us, that still small voice, and that is the voice of God. But we have the big ego voice, yeah! And that's the one we want to listen to. Some of the worst ideas I ever had came wearing the sexiest clothes. So I have to ask my sponsor. I have to ask other recovered people, what do you think of this? And listen to their feedback, because I just want to hear what I want to hear. I just want to hear what I want to hear. And if you're telling me what I don't want to hear, you're just sick. You're sick. You're in your illness. But I have to listen. When people are talking to me, I have to listen. We are often surprised how the right answers come after we have tried this for a while. What used to be the hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. Being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it is not probable we are going to be inspired at all times. We might pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely on it. We usually conclude the period of meditation with a prayer that we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be, that we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. We ask especially for freedom from self-will and are careful to make no requests for ourselves only. We may ask for ourselves, however, if others will be helped. We are careful never to pray for our own selfish ends. Many of us have wasted a lot of time doing that, and it doesn't work. You can easily see why. If circumstances warrant, we ask our wives or friends to join us in morning meditation. If we belong to a religious denomination which requires a definite morning devotion, we attend to that also. If not members of religious bodies, we sometimes select and memorize a few set prayers which emphasize the principles we have been discussing. There are many helpful books also. Suggestions about these may be obtained from one's priest, minister, or rabbi. Be quick to see where religious people are right. Make use of what they offer. As we go through the day, we pause when agitated. God is in the pause. We pause when agitated. God is in the pause. Or doubtful, and ask for the right thought or action. We constantly remind ourselves we're no longer running the show, humbly saying to ourselves many times each day, "Thy will be done." We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. We become much more efficient. We do not tire so easily, for we are not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. Here's the most important paragraph in the book. It works. It really does. Tattoo that in your brain. It works. It really does. You want proof that it works? Look in the back row. We alcoholics are undisciplined, so we let God discipline us in the simple way we have just outlined. But this is not all. There is action and more action. No thinking, no action and more action. Faith without works is dead, Ann Smith's favorite Bible verse. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12. Now, we haven't the time to go through everything in steps in chapter 7, and we're not going to. But we're going to take a look at this step 12, and it is a definite three-part step. And the very, very first part is having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Before you go out and you start 12-stepping people, make sure you've worked the steps and you've had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. Make sure you are in recovery. Otherwise, you're spreading the illness. You are spreading nothing. You have to have it to give it away, and by giving it away, you will get to keep lightning in a bottle. You will get to keep lightning in a bottle. You will never in your lifetime know any type of happiness, know any type of euphoria that can compare with having had that spiritual awakening and then giving it to others. And then the second part of the step here, which is very important. The first part is, they're all important, but having had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics. This is the message that we have. Not my message, not your message, not the message of your counselor and his food plan, not the message of whatever. This is the message we have. We are not marriage counselors. We are not psychological healers. We are not divorce consultants. We are none of those things. This is the message that we have. This book is the message that we have. You are carrying that message whether you want to be carrying it or you don't. When I was in complete relapse, when my daughter is 20 and I'm 16 years abstinent, when my daughter was not quite 2 years old, we were living in Eugene, Oregon, and I was in utter relapse, and I was carrying a message that I did not want to carry. It was a Sunday morning, just like this morning, and my then daughter and my then wife, I can see them now, were standing back to back. My then wife was putting away a massive grocery shop, and my little 19-month-old daughter picked up her little hand and opened up the refrigerator just about an inch and turned her head and said, "Shit, Esther, there's nothing in here." And if looks could kill, I would have been vaporized. And I can see it now. That was the message that I was sending to my little daughter, who I loved more than anything. You are carrying a message. Now, I'm living in Scottsdale, Arizona. This is years later. I'm in very good recovery. And an ABC comedy in prime time is on television. It's since gone off the air, about a guy and his brother who go around apologizing and making amends to people that they had hurt while they were wild. My daughter comes into the family room, looks at the television, looks at me, looks at the TV, looks at me and says, "This guy's just doing his eighth and ninth step, right, Dad?" Yeah. That's how far she had come by just being around me. That's how far she had come from the message that I was transmitting, and I didn't even know I was transmitting the message or tried to. You are transmitting a message. What is the message that you're transmitting? Are you aware that people may be looking and seeing and feeling and hearing what's going on with you? What message are you sending? That this doesn't work? Because what they're never going to see is, well, gosh, maybe OA doesn't work. No, they're not going to know you're not working your steps. They're going to think that the thing doesn't work. And it's very, very important. And you know, Dr. Bob, he bequeathed us with a beautiful, beautiful gift at the end of his life. At the end of his life, when he was very sick with cancer, the convention was in Cleveland, Ohio. And he had cancer, and he's helped up to the stage by one of the old alcoholics and his son. And he said some profound things. And one of the thing that he said was, let's not louse this up with complexities that are only of importance to the psychologist, the psychiatrist. He says, let's at the very base keep it simple. He said, let's keep it simple. And he said, what this boils down to is love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And he said, let's forever be wary of that erring member among us, the tongue. Let's use it judiciously. Let's use it to help the man up to the rung on the ladder on which you now stand. There's nothing complicated here. If they want it, you can transmit it to them. If they don't want it, there's nothing you can do. And they're not going to remember so much what you say to them when they're coming into their first meeting. They're going to remember how you made them feel. They're scared. They're broken. This is the last house on the block. My God, the pain that drives people into these rooms is no different than the horrific pain that drove you here. You didn't come here because things went well for you, did you? You didn't wake up and say, whoa, not bad. And you, well, that's my bank account? I think I'll go join OA. No, that's not how it works. You come in here under the whip of horrific pain. And God can utilize that pain, and He can mold you, and He can heal you, and He can do miracles through you. He can do miracles through you if you will just work these steps. If you will just do the work, you will never want for peace. You will never want for any of these things. And you've got to, you don't have to go to Yale or Harvard to know how to do this. That person that's coming in broken, to the world, you're a person. To that person, you could be the world. You could light them up. You can give them something that the psychiatrist couldn't give them. You can give them something that the therapist, that the nutritionist, that the hospital, that the bariatric center couldn't give them. You can give them hope. Because what is OA in 2015 is no different than it was in AA in 1935. It's one person communicating to another person through the language of the heart so that they have identification enough to begin taking actions which they do not yet believe in. Which they do not yet believe in, but they will do it because they see it working in you. Now, the Old Testament says something that's very important here. You save one life, you save the world. Take this responsibility and do it. Don't shirk it. We're hugging each other to death. There are people in the rooms dying beside you. Be an example of that recovery. Work these steps. Do what you need to do. Pay back. There is an unbroken chain of unbelievable, improbable, seemingly impossible miracles that occurred that began in 1935. on June the 10th, 1935, when Dr. Bob experienced his sobriety, eventually Alcoholics Anonymous was born, and it thrived. And in 1957, a man in Oxnard, California named Jim Willis, Jim W., started a group for people who gambled too much, who had an addiction to gambling. And he started a worldwide group called Gamblers Anonymous. One day in November of 1958, Roseanne S. saw on the Paul Coates show a show about Gamblers Anonymous. And in 1959, her and her husband, Marvin, went to a meeting of Gamblers Anonymous with a friend of her husband's who had a gambling addiction. And they went, and Roseanne heard identification. Remember, it's not information, it's identification. One to the other, the language of the heart. And to make a long story short, on January the 19th, 1960, the very first meeting of Overeaters Anonymous happened in Los Angeles, California. A couple of years later, in a place called Luling, Texas, there was a guy named A.G. Ainsworth. I feel his spirit all through here. I've seen A.G. at birthdays and conventions. Great big Texan, nice guy, hell of a nice guy. I'm sorry you'll never get to meet him. He has his story in the history of OA too. And A.G. Ainsworth was on a retreat, an Alcoholics Anonymous retreat, with a friend of his named Robert. And they stopped off at a bakery. Before they got to the bakery, A.G. Ainsworth asked Robert the same question that Roseanne asked Jim Willis. When Roseanne asked Jim, "Do you think a program like yours would help people like me with food?" He turned to her and said, "You know, Roseanne, I don't see why not." And A.G. Ainsworth in Luling, Texas, asked a question of Robert that said, "Do you think your AA steps would help somebody like me?" And he asked it in a way that if he got negative feedback, he could just say, "I was kidding." And Robert heard the pain in A.G.'s voice, and he said, "You know, A.G., I don't see why not." And A.G. got in touch with a lady named Norma B. Norma B. and A.G. Ainsworth started an organization in Luling, Texas, called Gluttons Anonymous. And if you look up in any good dictionary, that's really what we are. And when A.G. Ainsworth went to the local AA people to find out if anyone else was doing 12 steps about food, they put him in touch with Roseanne, and in 1962, he contacted Roseanne on a Sunday night, and he said it was like Stanley finding Livingston. By then, there were 16 groups of Overeaters Anonymous and 5 groups of Glutton Anonymous, and by a vote of 16-5 at the first convention, we became Overeaters Anonymous. Okay? And one meeting at a time, one person at a time, one miracle at a time, the message got to where you are. Don't kill it. Don't kill it. Don't make me come back here. Don't make me come back here. But these are miracles. Miracles that happens for most of us before we were born. And you are a miracle for being here. Many of you who are here right now had lots of reasons not to come here. There's a lot of reasons not to come here, but yet here you sit. Don't waste it. Don't waste it. Use it. Live this way. And you will not have to ever eat again compulsively throughout the days of your life. There will be miracles that will happen in your life. There will be things that happen in your life that you just cannot explain, that you just cannot even fathom. Don't stop the work. And the third part of the 12th step, which is just as important as anything else, and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. In everything that I do, I will practice these principles. Let's go to page 100. And let's read the 12-step promises. page 100. Both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. Now, before I close, I just want to tell you how grateful that I am. I'm trying not to cry. I just want you to know how grateful that I am to be here with you. I don't know that I did anything very special from up here during the last few days, but what I can tell you is that the reaction of you toward me here in Los Angeles has been nothing short of miraculous. You've all touched me very deeply. And I want you to know that the reason that I tell you this is to give you hope. I was the fattest kid in the school. I was the fattest person in any environment. People used to laugh at me from cars. Children used to laugh at me in shopping centers. People would point at me. People would walk up to me and I didn't even know them and they'd slap my stomach. I did not want to live in this world. I didn't know how. You gave me a book. You gave me your hand. You gave me a hug. You gave me your care. You gave me the phone call. You gave me the kind word. And you kept me going. That this is the greatest way of life in the world. The fat kid from Albany Street just did the big book study at the 2015 55th birthday of OA. And if that can happen for me, think of what is out there for you. Think of the miracles that God has in store for you. That he didn't bring you this far to drop you in Lake Michigan now. That no matter what you're going through tonight, tomorrow, you're going to go back to barking dogs and bosses and offices and traffic. Take God with you. You're going to go back into your lives. Some of you right after this, and some of, like me, I have to get on an airplane, and I'm going to go back to Arizona this afternoon. I'm going to go back to Phoenix, and then from there I'll drive to Scottsdale. And I'm going to take God with me, and I'm going to take your faces with me. I'm going to take the love that you had for me with me. So thank you very much. Let's close before I cry. Page 164, if you want to follow along. 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourselves to God, yourself to God as you understand God, steps 1, 2, and 3. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows, 4, 5, 6, 7. Clear away the wreckage of your past, 8, 9. Give freely of what you find and join us, 10, 11, and 12. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you so much. Thank you.